This is the Moonfest Destiny podcast, number 30. Moonfest Destiny is a novel I wrote in 1991, subtitled The Rough and Ready Balloon Invasion of the Lunar Peninsula of Texas. If this is the first time you're listening to this podcast, please start with episode 1. My name is Peter Gelman. Moonfest Destiny is available on Kindle for 99 cents. I will now read chapter 29, How I Saw the Elephant on the Sixth Day of Siege. Hordes of flies buzzed around the broke open belly of Fort Texas. The flies buzzed around everywhere, fat and happy. They drank water from the half-closed eyes of the men in their siege stupor. They feasted on the delicious and juicy scabs and scratches on our arms. While we masticated the ever-decreasing portions of salt cracker and hardtack into a limestone and sand paste, suitable for bricking up our innards, the winged vermin made a banquet of this bombardment. Most of them lived with Louis XIV's splendor in the infirmary. These 6 days of lunar bombs, a bastion all around our bomb-proof, had reduced us Calhounian crawdads of Company C to a sullen net of biped crustacean. With 3 false alarms during the night, we waded through the dark hours, sleeplessly clutching our muskets, fixing and unfixing our electric bayonets, ever expecting General Lunarista's assault. But it didn't come. We crouched in crowded rank, ready to mount the walls. The luminous fog in our annunciators grew dim. The general order came to drain and freshen our annunciators phosphoric and test each pile's sulfuric. We crowded in line as best we could with our pile lids unlatched, while the sergeants and corporals inspected the condition and alignment of our copper and zinc plates. Kelly inspected the voltages of the ranks, with all eyes on the thick needle of his galvanometer box. Still we waited. Like the rest of the slow pokes, we were plenty exhausted. The phosphoric in us was stale. Our springs were run down. No more did we sing songs, neither patriotic nor bawdy. Half-lit McCoy's concertina lay smudged in the dirt, trampled to splinters by the Pythagorean brethren, as the musics called themselves. With dark and dirty eyes, we stared our ugly expression at the strata of lantern-lit darkness, letting the flies drink our sweat. A small hiss of steam and clank of iron joints announced the arrival of PPFS, his moral surgeon sash, much stained by soot smoke, saltpeter, dried blood, acid drops, and dirt. Tick, stick, stick, tick, ick, ick. His gray swirling glass marble eyes stared dimly at us, and, ticking out his moral duty, he observed, "Dugout number 1, I have an announcement." The men groaned. "Who cares?" I said. "Silence," cried Kelly. "Tick, this announcement has 2 parts. The first part is number 1. The second part is number 2. The first part follows. Tick." Some of the men roused themselves to boo and hiss. "Go make eyes at a locomotive," I heckled. Kelly glared at me, then at Sergeant Mallory. Mallory sullenly waited for permission to thrash me. The company was under the false impression that I had bested Kelly's constable, but I had just given us both a jolt of the good galvanic. We were too burnt out afterwards to fight. Kelly was perplexed about what to do with me. A discipline problem under the protection of his natural sympathy. Number one, Tick, our acting commander, Captain Miles, has directed me to advise you on your sloppy uniforms. You look like locked-out manufacturing waifs in a bank crisis. Tick. Now Prince Prez, called Sergeant Williams of Company B, rousing himself to defend the reputation of himself and his men. As he spoke, he buttoned his ragged collar. That ain't fair. We are doughboys of Rough and Ready, not fuss and feathers. Ain't we, boys? He called, expecting a rallying cheer, but all he got was a few desultory yes. The metal man snorted a little more steam and clinked a step forward. Look at you! Filthy, dull, meek, tick, tock! Who represents progress? Eggs, tick! And civilization? His gears seemed to slip a cog or two, then catch up. I protested. But you can't sneak under the big top tent to see the circus elephant, lest you get your knees dirty. It's the spirit of the thing that counts, not the look of it. I stood up, but averted my gaze from the confusion of his mesmeric miles of gray spirals. Thick, black, and greasy coke smoke dribbled down around the edges of the metal man's stovepipe, its writhing snake coils shrouding his handsome porcelain mask, hinting of a hideous, guppy, gaping grin, gulping the foul fumes. But his dumb gray eyes burned through, unkind eyes of nature, stupidly lurid, lizardish, with thickly languorous lids. He spoke in such a soft, lisping hiss of steam puffs that I almost didn't hear what it was impossible for him to say. Tick, what is the weight and measure of spirit? If you weigh a corpse immediately before and after death, is there a change? What is that change? What accounts for the messy look of spiritless decay, but the one and only spirit, the spirit of the worm? Is not that worm your own animating spirit? Jack Borginnis, graduate of Camp Greenhorn? What? I cried. Beside me, Kidney Beanton and Six Fingers Bordet exchanged glances. Ever since my little rampart jig and tussle with the Sarge, there was talk of me going off my rocker. I didn't care. If I was, I wasn't the only one. Weren't we regulars all giving up ourselves as slaves to the president? Why'd he send us to steam up to the moon in stinging balloons to die for? Of course, that was the regular life of a regular, which is why hardly any American respected or even tolerably liked soldiers of their own army, even. Last I heard, Congress was about to cut West Point from the budget because it was so undemocratic and useless. That ruffled my fur the wrong way, let me tell you. Here I was about to get stuck in the gut by 10 or 12 lunar bayonets. And all the citizens I was protecting, so very far away, all them folks sitting by their fireplaces, thought of me as nothing more than a slacker and a drunkard. And they were the same young Americans who voted in my commander-in-chief. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. Of course I was a bit lazy, and I did like to have a drink or two, or three even, maybe four sometimes. But I wasn't so different than most folks, mostly. I didn't have big ears like Six Fingers, nor wasn't even Mormon for that matter. Although it was true that certain dire tribulations had caused me to slacken my grip on my lasso of belief. In fact, that lasso of disbelief I now held was nothing but a slipknot noose of atheism tight around my yelping throat, by which means the lightning bearded, iron-visaged, awful deity dangled me so jovially over the inquisitorial iron racks, bone-crippling cages, and hot stoves of hell. Like a plumb line, I dangled on the straight and narrow between right and wrong. But at least I wasn't ugly and disfigured like Half-Lip, who had to pay his whores double. Though I was one, I had no mark that branded me an awful sinner, and I aimed to keep it that way. Since there was no judgment, there was no crime. That is why, when the moral surgeon reminded me of my crime, he reminded me that I had taken it upon myself to transfix my guilty carcass on my own lightning bolt of retribution. And that is why, in my private agony and shame, I did what I did a little while later. PPFS ticked on. Number 2 follows. Tick. I, Prince President Franklin Stove, offer breakneck fast crematorium services to any and all corpses. This astonished the dugout. I broke out of my dingy mesmerism. Angry. What insult is this? Asked Lieutenant Fisk of Company B. What the deuce, man? Called Kelly. You'd bet quit this game, or your goose is cooked. Tick, not goose. He's mad, said Six Fingers. He's making me mad, said one of the pugilists of Company C. Tick, my purpose is reason itself. Reason is the reduction of the irrational to rational parts. My reduction of the corpse to cinders is certain and performed at breakneck speed. The men murmured, beyond booing. This is too much, said Lieutenant Fisk to Kelly. What are we going to do about it, boys? I said, turning round to the crawdads. Silence, said Kelly. Tick, first I break the bones into 10-inch sizes in order to fit them in my furnace. Second, I... Quit, Professor, or you'll pay for these wisecracks, warned Sergeant Mallory. His eyelids ticked tin taps up and down, seemingly in gear-slipping stutter. Tick, this service is indeed gratuitous. I offer satisfaction, rendering your flesh into boiler pressure. Hey, I've had enough of this chess player. What do you say, boys? Get 'em! The men moved forward a few steps. Tick, it is the only sure way to harness progress to the sloppy work of the worm. We done already tarred and feathered him once. Looks like we got to bust his head off. Tick. Easy, boys, easy, said Lieutenant Fisk. He turned to PPFS. Now you get out of here, or I don't know what will happen. Tick, have you ever ruminated upon the sloppy work of the worm? An example follows. Get 'em, someone called. Fisk drew his saber, and so did Kelly. They held their sabers lengthwise together, the moral surgeon behind them. The sergeants tried to push the men back, but couldn't. Get 'em, I cried. He's against us. Do it for Jackson, boys. That hit a chord, which reverberated. For Jackson! Tick, stick. The men pushed the sergeants back against the lieutenants. Whoever shall attempt to harm the surgeon, said Lieutenant Fisk, shall receive 10 lashes. The men hesitated at this and fell back. The lieutenants nodded and sheathed their sabers. Tick, has anyone seen Sergeant Weigert? Don't let him eat poor Oscar, I shouted. Revenge for Oscar! I dodged to the fore. Revenge! The men shouted, pushing me forward. The lieutenants disappeared. The too benign face of the metal man was right before me. Something clicked in my brain. I vented a gust of fury, an escape valve of my snarl, yelling, "Rah!" I grabbed his porcelain ears and shook him hard. The mesmeric gray lights dimmed. Automatically, I tripped him Apache style, as Mallory taught me back at Camp Greenhorn. and with a dozen hands pressing down on me, I toppled over his scalding chest and pushed myself back up again with one hand. With the other, I smacked his big, hard, white face. Some of the men were yelling, "Kill him! Kill him!" and someone tried to pull me off. As I fell back, I tore the moral surgeon's sash off. The automaton wriggling on his back like an overturned turtle. I could hear the resounding clang of the men kicking him with their boots. I heard Kelly shouting at me, and I shrugged free to smack the Prince President again. "Roo! Roo! Rah! Tuck! Tuck! Rah!" he screamed, the sound of thousands of tiny iron teeth being stripped from their wheels. I heard Martha Miles screaming, "Stop! Stop!" as I smacked him again. The metal man stung my arm with steam. He squirted scalding gas all around. We fell away. He rolled to left and then to right, pushing upward, and stood up. One of his eyes glowed murkily. The other was dark. The glowing eye flickered in its murk, light heat lightning in heavy clouds. "Just who or what are you?" I demanded as they pulled me back. He ticked, seeming to consider. "Tick, stick, stick, tick, ick, ick. Who am I? Chickens peck anything at all. Don't put your fingers in their craw. My hens lay eggs for snakes to eat. Rattlesnakes so hungry for meat. Round and around like stars they go. How fast stars fall, you soon will know. The worm is kind. He likes to joke. Tail and mouth, the planets choke. The stars are the brain of God. He's a bit odd. He's quite odd. Tar and feather me. String me up. My birds peck at bones for their sup. Such happy birds will then lay eggs. Snakes eat white coal, spit out the dregs. I manufacture sums of quirks. What I make is called cruel works. I am the widget of the worm. Rest you assured that he will turn. He breathes in death and comes out birth. Moon will crack in the fangs of earth. And he turned and marched out of the bombproof. You bad luck charm, I called after him. My fist was numb. I was looking at it when Lieutenant Fisk grabbed me. His face twisted sourly as Mallory tore off my dirty blouse and bound my wrists to the dugout rafter. Captain Miles came down to find out what was going on. Outside, we learned from the heated talk of the officers, the sentinels had challenged the metal man as he marched down the outer slope. Under Captain Hawkins' orders, they ran down to grab him, but he eluded them through the ditch, where they got caught in the brambles themselves. He disappeared into the dark. Enraged, Hawkins fired several rounds of grapeshot, hoping to stop the deserter. We wouldn't know until the morning. Captain Miles gave me a hard glance. "Carry on," he said. At first he stood with arms crossed, watching, but when he discovered Martha standing behind him, he guided her into the gallery and was gone. Thank you for listening. I haven't read this book in a long time, and I forgot the events of this chapter. We'll see what happens next. The title of this chapter, How I Saw the Elephant on the Sixth Day of Siege, refers to seeing the elephant. At the time that I wrote this, I thought the origin of that phrase was the American circus. Well, I looked it up on the internet, on Wikipedia, now that the internet has been invented, and it has a complicated history. Apparently, it has many sources, and it's not quite clear. Circus is one of them. Here's what the Wikipedia says. The phrase, seeing the elephant, is an Americanism of the mid to late 19th century, seen throughout the United States in the Mexican-American War, the Texas Santa Fe Expedition, the American Civil War, the 1849 Gold Rush, and the westward expansion trails, Oregon Trail, California Trail, Mormon Trail. The mythical elephant was an extremely popular way of expressing an overwhelming emotion. But when historians started taking note of its recurrence in the historical newspapers, journals, and literature, they often summed the elephant up too quickly and categorized it as a negative experience. Desolation and sadness may have been one trait of seeing the elephant, but it was certainly not the only or the most prevalent. Most often, American pioneers of the Overland Trail talk of the excitement and anticipation of heading west to see the elephant. Elephant, quote, sightings, unquote, often begin with the excitement and high ideals, only to be disappointed or disenchanted. The high excitement followed by low frustrations are what epitomize the elephant as something most wanted to see, but few have wanted to see again. The rest of the article traces the long and varied sources of the phrase, which include the circus. The mythical animal was more than just a term for an ordeal. It was an expression for a tribulation that was ironic or directly followed excitement of some kind. Budapest Destiny by Peter Gelman is available on Kindle for 99 cents. Thank you.